This particular presentation, Hype or Hope for Personalized Pain Medicine, Team Science, and Investigational Solutions. There's been in the wake of the Human Genome Project, there's been a great deal of enthusiasm for individual therapeutics and personalized medicine. Many public health people are not sure if this effort is not a diversion from more basic public health efforts. And I understand this because over time, we have made enormous gains in health through population-based strategies that actually are targeted at much larger groups. But I want to assure you that I have come around to the perspective at NIH that this is a complementary effort, that scientific advances better permit characterizations. I'm muting him. Scientific advances that permit better characterization of subpopulations and individuals at the genomic levels may ultimately lead to better treatments with fewer side effects and fewer deleterious impacts, and in particular for vulnerable populations. This is not at all contradictory to public health, but as I said, complementary. And because of the significance of pain, and pain is not just a symptom, but pain is now recognized as a disease in and of itself, this is absolutely within the purview of public health and within prevention, because we also know that if we can prevent pain and stop it early on, even at the secondary prevention level, that we can prevent chronic pain from continuing on. So our very ambitious talk today will demonstrate the relevance of public health and pain, as well as pain disparities, how far we've come in this quest, and how we may make greater progress with the reliance on discovery research. Next slide, please. Next slide. Now, I probably haven't convinced everybody as to why pain is a... Next slide. I already went over it. Why pain is a public health issue. Well, how many people here have ever been in pain? Ever. It's actually a dangerous thing if you don't feel pain. Really, you have a shorter lifespan if you do not feel pain. Pain, under its normal circumstances, is a signal. However, pain is an enormous problem because it affects over 100 million people, adults. And this number actually, when you combine it, is higher. Pain numbers are higher than heart disease, diabetes, and cancer combined. So this is a significant issue. It reduces quality of life, it reduces function, it reduces mental health status. There are enormous scopes that we can't even get into. The cost that is conservatively estimated is $560 to $635 billion annually, with $261 to $300 of those being direct healthcare costs, and 297 to 336 in lost productivity. Next slide. At this point in time, though, we still need more consistent data, and we must monitor changes in incidence and prevalence, document the rates of treatment and undertreatment. There are still huge numbers of people being undertreated. Assess and integrate the societal consequences from a social determinants perspective and evaluate the impacts that changes in policy can have on pain, payment, and care. So we need population-based strategies to reduce pain and its consequences, and this should be targeted to heighten the national concern about pain and awareness, use of public health strategies to foster pain in self-management, inform the public about the nature of pain, and identify and eliminate disparities that are financial, cultural, structural, gender-based, and racial. Next slide. So in this slide, you'll see that it's one of the classic social determinants of health. Chronic pain, we know, people have lower functional status. They tend to attain lower education. Housing quality tends to be lower, poorer communities, and employment status. Now, what have we been seeing throughout this conference? Your zip code determines your health, right? Okay, this is true for pain as well. And there's a definite correlation with higher disability and where you live in a community. The epigenomic, physical, environmental, and social communicability factors must be considered. I would also argue that pain is intergenerationally passed on. This is not just through genetics. From a behavioral science perspective, which is what my master's is in, I absolutely believe that if people are living in poor quality housing, where they're exposed to things such as cockroach feces and a variety of other types of crime, for example, drive-by shootings, they are in communities where there are food deserts, they don't have safe playgrounds, they are much more likely to suffer chronic pain. And this then becomes a socially communicable on top of the genetic link. So we wind up with a very intricate pattern where this is passed on from generation to generation. If your parent is on disability and they're not able to move out of a community that they don't want to be in, or they are not able to work and they're not able to send you to the schools that you want or get you into the public schools that you should be in or that they believe you should be, this is all going to impact what you attain in your lifespan. I have a lot more to say about this, but we are actually running short on time. I will say that the health disparities in public health are actually recognized in Healthy People 2020, and they recognize that communities, states, and national organizations will need to take a multidisciplinary approach to achieve health equity, and that includes pain across a lifespan. Next slide. So I don't expect anybody to be able to read the details on this slide, but how many of you saw Gail Sheehy's talk? And she talked about passages. Well, I added the passages part of this afterwards. So I adapted her work from the general session, and I truly believe that there are pain passages in utero, birth, childhood, adolescence, young adulthood, middle age, older life, end of life, and in caregiving. We know that caregivers suffer more pain, more depression, and there is an entire cycle with regard to that. And it is, next slide, sorry. For example, with caregivers, we can look at things like prevalence of joint pain. And this is one of the things that joint pain may not seem like a public health problem, but it is a public health problem when you look at the multiple facets and the social determinants and the fact that we have caregivers who are now older caregivers, and they are suffering, and they are lifting patients. And I can give you lots of data on this, but the National Center for Health Statistics has some wonderful data that 76.2 million, or one in every four Americans, have suffered pain that lasts longer than 24 hours, and millions more suffer acute pain. So this is not just chronic, it's acute pain that can turn into chronic pain, and we actually know that there's brain structure change that occurs. At this point, I'm going to turn over, you can start hitting, I'll take over. Dr. Dion is, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, can everybody hear you? Go ahead.
Okay, can you just clarify the timeline? It seems like you left me 30 seconds for my talk.
Oh, I have. you're fine. Let me look at the clock. I'd say you've got 30.
Encourage me to speed up or quiet down at a time.
Okay, go for it.
All right. Well, good morning, and thanks for the opportunity to participate in this symposium, despite the best attempts of Hurricane Sandy to exclude me. The slide hopefully you're looking at is a timeline that traces milestones in understanding of pain and development of new analgesics over the last 50 to 60 years. I'll just truncate my comments to point out that in the 50s, we started with three drug classes, primarily narcotics, aspirin-like drugs, and adjunctive agents. And 50 years later, we had renamed the aspirin-like drugs the NSAIDs, but they were still relatively similar in efficacy and toxicity. Narcotics became opioids with many of the same drugs used clinically. We added acetaminophen to the mix and gabapentinoids, but the consequences that drugs that are currently used for chronic pain are very similar to ones we've had in the past, all of which have similar adverse effects that limit their efficacy for pain relief. While the future holds great promise for progress on scientific advances, there was a meeting at the FDA last week that I attended on the development of new analgesics, which clearly indicates that the pharmaceutical industry has moved away from developing drugs for pain due to this remarkable poor return on investment associated with this track record. So this suggests then on the next slide that we have a dilemma of large unmet therapeutic needs for pain relief and a failure to innovate therapeutics and have diminished interest by the pharmaceutical industry. So we probably have to consider some sort of a paradigm shift, which is illustrated on this slide for those of you who learned how to drive on a four-speed transmission. We're trying to move away from observational studies and gene association studies to doing more genome-wide types of studies and eventually learn at the epigenetic level and the sequence level what's going on that will help us to define molecular genetic subtypes. We could go to the next slide. This slide here illustrates one of the recent innovations, which is the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, which has focused a lot of interest on pain research and keeps it at the national policy level, which will hopefully result in more ERA-funded pain research projects coming in the near future. We could go to the next slide. One of the initial efforts was an IOM-sponsored conference on pain that resulted in a report to Congress that we'd like to share with you on the next slide, please. Some of the findings of this ERA Act include advancing research and treatment for pain care management by continuing to expand basic and clinical pain research. There are recommendations for future pain research initiatives. The establishment of a DHS-wide pain research coordinating committee, and as I mentioned, the Institute of Medicine-sponsored conference on pain. The next slide shows some of the highlights from the pain report, where it's recognized that effective pain management is a moral imperative, that chronic pain can actually be a disease in itself that persists long after the precipitating injury has healed. Comprehensive treatment approaches are considered optimum interdisciplinary approaches to research are also necessary. Prevention, as it's mentioned, is paramount as it's much more easy to deal with pain before it's become well established. There's probably a need for wider use of existing knowledge. We have to deal with the conundrum of opioids, which are extremely effective but have a large number of side effects and detrimental consequences. And we would hope that eventually collaborative relationship partnerships between patients and clinicians and public health community-based approaches will improve the situation. The next slide illustrates or summarizes some of the research challenges, which one of the problems is we've had significant advances in understanding basic pain mechanisms, but there's been largely a failure to translate this into improved therapeutics, especially in terms of safety. And there needs to possibly be considered some sort of a cultural transformation in the view of an approach to pain research. Part of the report by the IOM had a recommendation that we need to improve the process for developing new agents for pain control and charge the NIH, the FDA, the pharmaceutical industry, academic-based researchers, and even private funders of research to this task. In reality, however, the expertise for developing new chemical entities for targets that have been identified through NIH-funded academic researchers is still largely done by the pharmaceutical industry with regulatory oversight by the FDA. But the drug development process has changed markedly for neuroscience indications, as indicated on the next slide. Major pharmaceutical firms that have abandoned or decreased the development of drugs for neuroscience indications, such as pain, include Novartis, GSK, AstraZeneca, Pfizer, Merck, and Sanofi. These are the same firms that have developed, that have led the development of novel analgesics over the past few decades. Many other pharma firms that developed drugs for pain relief in the past are no longer in business. The new business model for drug development is largely based on the use of biotech industry, but they are usually modestly funded, don't last long if they're not successful, while it is estimated that the cost for developing a novel chemical entity and bringing it to market is approximately $1 billion. So this recommendation of the IOM for improving analgesic drug development will likely not be healed by the pharmaceutical industry in its present form. Another consideration for the slow progress that was identified by the IOM in the Pain in America report is shown here with all these reports that have been issued in the last 15 years. They identify these as being very similar to what they have done and provide similar recommendations that has resulted in little evidence of progress towards the well-articulated goals and documented findings of the past. So these perspectives might suggest a cup that is half filled with stagnant water. But we are from the government, and we're here to help. So this slide shows the results of multiple NIH institutes that are fostering interdisciplinary efforts under the umbrella of the NIH Blueprint for Neuroscience Research. This is a cooperative effort among 16 NIH institutes, centers, and offices that support neuroscience research, including pain, and pools the resources and the expertise to support the development of new tools, training opportunities, and other resources to assist neuroscience in both research and clinical support. If you go on to the next slide,
please.
This shows another trans-agency effort, the NIH Pain Consortium, that was created in 1996. But more recently has created a process for developing of common fund initiatives for new research funding. The NIH is in the process of developing these new recommendations. They get to submit them as an independent institute or center and as part of the regular process. And these recommendations are reviewed by the executive committee that eventually forwards one of two of these each year for funding by the Commons Fund. And in fact, there have been two initiatives that have been submitted in recent months. So this is a new strategy, new line of funding that holds hope for making more money available for pain research.
Ray, you've got like 3 to 5 minutes, okay?
Okay, let me just mention another one here, which is the another initiative by the Pain Consortium that holds promise for improving pain relief by establishing centers of excellence in pain education, and this was recently funded by a dozen sites across the country. Okay, similarly, on the next slide, we see the patient-reported outcomes measurement information system that has been successfully implemented and is moving forward with new strategies for making this a more useful tool for being able to actually develop deep phenotyping of pain patients.
Okay.
Moving on then, I'd like to make a couple of generalizations about the scientific part of this process. And this slide here illustrates some of the complexity of pain perception, in that sensory input involves a variety of receptors, pain mediators, and peripheral pathways, all of which are subject to genetic variation. The pathophysiology of pain, inflammation, and CNS plasticity modulates the transmission of pain to the CNS, where it is also subject to genetic variability. The overall result of these multiple pathways, mechanisms, and genetic variation is an incredible wide range between a stimulus and the ultimate perception of pain by an individual. This is illustrated on the next slide, which shows the full range of possible responses to the same stimulus from a group of 500 patients who rated a fixed noxious stimuli to their skin as either being no pain all the way up to the worst pain imaginable. This variability across individuals to an identical pain stimulus emphasizes the need for personalized pain therapeutics, as clearly the experience of pain varies widely at the level of the individual patient. This is reinforced by the next slide, which shows the wide variation of pain following a standardized surgical procedure. While it is not possible to control the level of physical injury as precisely as an experimental stimulus, this variability across subjects also supports the assertion that pain perception varies widely across individuals and that a one-size-fits-all strategy is unlikely to work for all patients, especially as the process of inflammation magnifies pain perception and also varies across individuals. Okay, let's skip a bunch of slides here, Chris, so I can get to the generalizations at the end. So I'm going to keep moving forward to about slide 31, which shows the role of gender, ethnicity, and generic variability on pain. And it shows the results of studies using experimental cold pain, keeping one's hand in a bucket of ice water, to evaluate the association with variations in genes thought to be related to pain. These data reinforce previous findings that gender and ethnicity are important parts of the pain perception variability, but also suggested that an enzyme associated with the endogenous pain inhibitory system, identified as FAAH, was resulted in part of the variability to pain. Unfortunately, so this would suggest then that this would be a novel target for analgesic drug development. Unfortunately, several speakers at the FDA conference last week indicated that investigational drugs directed at this novel target have already failed in early clinical trials. These studies have not been published, however, it is not possible to determine if subgroups that expressed genetic variants might have received benefit, but that this effect was minimized when pooled with the entire sample. The next slide, we see a similar finding for the TRPV1 receptor, which is the receptor that transduces the stimulus of heat into the perception of pain. In a study in 700 patients, this was shown to drive the responses to pain perception in the whole group, even though only about 10% of the subjects had this particular variability. So again, it's possible then that the subgroup would have benefited from a drug directed at this target. But again, this particular target has been a subject of investigation by the pharmaceutical industry, and they've abandoned it now for lack of efficacy. Similarly, on the next slide, we can see for one of the most popular pain genes, catechol-O-methyltransferase, there is a balance between positive and negative studies, which also makes this association problematic as a factor for understanding genetics of pain. Similarly, on the next slide, the most logical genetic variant, the mu opioid receptor, has proven to have many studies, both significant and non-significant, with the outcome that a meta-analysis found no consistent associations between this gene and most of the phenotypes for pain. Very depressingly, last week at the FDA meeting, one of the investigators reported a study in over 2,000 twins using experimental pain and indicated a failure to replicate almost all of the published pain associations, as well as they did come up with one new finding, but they haven't submitted that for publication yet. So this report and the suggestion that the need to temper our enthusiasm for using genetic risk factors for individualizing pain management in the near future. All right, Chris, let's jump way to the end here so I can have the chance to just generalize a little bit. So I'm moving up to, let's go back to slide 40, which should show my version of the genomic prescribing system, or GPS. Have you got that up?
No, I'm going by number, by what is the title? There you go.
GPS.
Got it. You're up.
Okay. So a goal then for learning about the genetic contributions to pain and analgesia is illustrated by this figure, which shows that possibility of prescribing pain medications that would be better matched to the individual's genomic makeup and would eventually result in drugs that might be more effective or safe for a specific patient, rather than basing the evaluation on the mean responses of large groups of subjects who participated in the initial clinical trials. This genomic prescribing system would function like today's GPS to evaluate genetic variations in DNA, changes in gene expression due to the injury or chronic pain condition, and the resulting changes in protein function to suggest what treatment would work best for an individual patient. This may sound preposterous, but consider the analogy to GPS that hardly existed 15 or 20 years ago has now become widespread and very, very reliable. So let's just skip then to a concluding couple of slides. One is headed Pentagon, which is slide 43.
Got it. I have it.
This describes, pardon?
I have it. And they also, I made handouts too, so anyone who's having a hard time following the speed of this particular presentation, you do have handouts. Go ahead.
Okay. All right, then I'll sign off.
No. Go ahead and finish that.
Okay. All right. Well, let me just make one generalization here then. On slide 45, there's a schematic that shows a molecular genetic dissection of multi-symptom disorders, and this would apply for pain. And this sort of describes how it might work, where we would take phenotype data, genetic expression data, epigenetic data, and sequence data to eventually identify genomic subgroups and novel therapeutic targets. Now, someone has coined the phrase the hype cycle to describe the interaction between hype and hope, where a new technology such as genomics is introduced with great enthusiasm, only to be followed by an emotional low when it fails to immediately deliver on its promise. The trough of disillusionment can often be replaced by the slope of enlightenment that eventually breaks new ground. So returning to the question that we posed for this session, let's hope that the hype over personalized medicine eventually leads to improved pain management by individualizing new and existing analgesics to improve efficacy and safety for each patient. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Dion.